Lecture 17, Life in a Mesopotamian City.
We saw in the last lecture that the Ur III period was prosperous and culturally vibrant, but that most of our evidence came from the palace, and specifically from the reign of Shulgi. In this lecture, I would like to return to one of the themes of our course, urbanism, to see what developments have occurred since we last explored the topic in the Uruk era, about a millennium ago. We know how important public institutions were in cities, were best informed about the temple, and also have become increasingly well informed about the palace, which supported, together with the temple, a large workforce that could provide work and food for the poorest members of the city. What can we reconstruct about the rest of the city? Keep in mind that most of our archaeological evidence is richest for temples and palaces. And so what survives, what has even been excavated in the rest of these enormous tells, is very scattered. So as I talk about cities in the second millennium, I'm going to extrapolate from several centuries and from many different sites to create a picture. Texts fill in some of the gaps that archaeological evidence leaves for us, but there are still many questions that remain. We will begin on a small scale by looking at the house and its occupants, and then move to local government. And I have to warn you that this is an especially vague aspect of urban life that we would like to be better informed about. Then I will move on to discuss the different professions that are attested for cities, and finally end with two studies of specific cities, Sippar and Nuzi. Keep in mind that one of the reasons we chose the aspect of urbanism to explore in this course is to understand that while political events that seem momentous to us were occurring, most people in Mesopotamia continued living their lives relatively unaffected by what happened among the political elite. So it's important to keep returning to this theme, to keep in mind what the average citizen of Sumer would have been doing while Shulgi was rampaging around and building temples. Cities can be best understood as large versions of individual households. And so any study of an individual household, both the occupants and the structure itself, is important for our understanding of the city as a whole. Fathers were the undisputed head of the household, and they lived surrounded by their family. Parents, sons, their sons' wives, and sometimes their children, and any unmarried daughters would live together in one household. So it's an extended family, but it's not a vast extended family. It's usually just no more than three generations at most. Fathers arranged the marriage of both their sons and their daughters, and women were married in their late teens, men in their late 20s. So there's about a 10-year age gap in the age of first marriage. The groom's family would give a gift to the family of the bride. In the early dynastic era, this consisted of large quantities of food meant to provide for the wedding feast or for the family. But later, by the 18th century, this was silver in an amount equal to the dowry given to the groom by the bride's father. And the dowry was a gift given by the father of the bride to support her. It was supposed to ensure that she didn't get married and then her husband lost his job, lost his livelihood, and she would be left to starve. She and her children would be left to starve. Instead, the dowry was meant to provide the necessities for her. It was overseen by the groom, by the husband, but in the event of divorce, the dowry would have to be returned to the bride's family. We'll come back to this idea when we discuss laws, because dowries are often the subject of legal disputes.